questions about the things he was just told, but he couldn't risk being too curious. He needed to pick his questions carefully. For now, it was enough to know that Yarrett was more akin to a record keeper than a spy master. Shrewd, perhaps, but not seasoned.
So, what are you? A census taker?
No, no, Tennick said. I am one of Yarrett's cupbearers. The term sounded archaic, and it was not the first time Mikael had heard a Dionysus use it. He seemed to remember that it was an honorarium in the court of Cressian kings.
I'm not familiar with the term. What is your role?
I have no role, and I have every role, Tennick said, spreading his arms.
A cupbearer is a trusted member of the household who takes on whatever the name needs doing. I have been many things. For now, I am your bodyguard and assistant.
It's an honored position.
Very.
Looking after me seems beneath you.
Not at all. You are a high-ranking member of the Black Hats. Your place within the household has yet to be determined, but you are not a slave.
He paused.
No. What is the word for the lowliest member? He said something in Dionysus, then... Commoner? Is that the word?
I think I get your meaning, Mikael said.
Good. By the way, you never answered my question.
Which one?
How does this help us catch the culprit behind the bombings?
Mikael pulled himself away from his myriad of questions and nodded to the tenement across the street.
I'm waiting for someone.
Who?
A woman named Hendrez. We worked together for a brief time after the war started.
How will she be useful?
Because she knows that I turned. I'm willing to bet that with me gone, she will have spent the last couple of days tracking down the highest-ranking blackhead in the city. With any luck, it's a gold rose who, if not personally responsible for the bombings, will probably have a good idea who is.
You were friends with this Hendrez woman?
Mikael decided not to mention their time as lovers.
Partners. We were trying to figure out how to save families of blackouts from your purges.
And why did you stop being partners?
Because I decided that joining you was more efficient.
Mikael didn't much like this line of questioning, and hoped that it came across in his voice.
Tennick didn't seem to notice.
How do you know she'll come here?
I don't, Mikael said.
A glance at Tennick's face revealed the other's scepticism, and he continued,
Hendrez isn't a spy. She was an enforcer, then a bureaucrat. Everything she knows about sneaking around, she learned from me in the last month.
And?
And we work from the same list of safe houses. The safe house across the street is one of the few we never discuss using as a backup. Hendrez is smart enough to have ditched our backup safe houses, and will only use those she thinks I'm less likely to search. If she doesn't show up at this one tonight, we'll check one of the others tomorrow.
Mikael gave the explanation offhand, and it didn't occur to him until he'd finished speaking what exactly he just revealed. He risked a quick glance at Tennick, whose eyes were still focused on the street. He was just beginning to think Tennick hadn't noticed the slip, when Tennick asked,
"How does Hendrez know that you're working for us?"
The question was posed in a quiet, thoughtful tone.
Mikael licked his lips.
"It's, complicated. I think I could follow an explanation."
Mikael grew even more cognizant of the fact that Tennick had been sent to keep an eye on him. Everything he shared with Tennick would be revealed to Yarrett, and might affect Mikael's standing. Carelessly giving away information, he decided,
would be a stupid way to end his short stint with the Dionys.
Andrus accused me of being a spy for the Dionys, Mikkel said. She tried to kill me.
You became a traitor because you were falsely accused of being a traitor?
Mikkel didn't like the word traitor. It ignored the complexities of what being a spy actually meant.
Yes, he said.
And why did she think you were a traitor?
Because one of her safe houses was raided by Dionys soldiers while I was away. She barely escaped, and only the two of us knew about the safe house.
It was close enough to the truth for Mikkel.
He added a twist of anger to his words, also real, and clicked his tongue.
Speaking of which, do you see that woman with the brown hair down at the end of the street?
I do.
That's her.
Mikkel took a deep breath to calm himself as he watched Hendra's mill about the intersection at the end of the street, checking subtly for a possible ambush. Her body language was tense, and she checked the street, rooftops and tenement doorways several times before finally coming down the street and heading inside. It seemed she was still spooked from coming back to the Dionys stakeout last week.
She didn't see us,
Tenik observed.
She didn't check the windows at all, Mikkel said. She really needs to learn to do that.
What next?
You don't have to whisper, Mikkel responded. Even if she was still in the street, she wouldn't hear us.
Tenik cleared his throat, and his cheeks flushed. So, what next? He asked in a normal voice.
Now we wait. Tenik rolled his eyes and returned to the corner of the room, slumping down on the floor. The familiar flicking sound of him flipping a coin soon began. Mikkel waited, nearly stepping back from the window when he saw a curtain flutter in Hendra's safe house room.
Now we know where she's staying, Mikkel said over his shoulder. We can come back tomorrow morning and wait until she goes out. And then...
He paused as Hendra suddenly appeared in the tenement doorway.
Shit, never mind. Come with me now!
Mikkel left the room at a run, heading down the hallway without waiting to see if Tenik had followed him. He went up two floors, then climbed out the window of an abandoned apartment and round the ledge, then hiked himself up onto the roof. He crossed it in a few moments and crouched down, searching the traffic below. It wasn't long until he spotted Hendra's heading north. He heard a clatter behind him, and Tenik joined him a moment later with a string of words in Dionys that were definitely curses.
Come on, Mikkel told him, heading to the other side of the roof and quickly climbing down the chimney sweep's ladder.
He caught up to Hendra's a few blocks later, falling into step 100 paces back and pulling his hat down over his face. He indicated that Tenik do the same.
The trick to following someone, Mikkel explained in a low voice, is to stay far enough away that they won't suspect you're onto their tail, but close enough that you won't lose them when they inevitably turn corners or go into buildings.
What happens when they go into buildings?
Depends. If you're trying to catch them, you make sure it's not a trap, then set your own. It helps to have some thugs with you.
And if you're not trying to catch them?
Then you wait until they come out again.
Tenik groaned. Hold up, Mikkel said, turning to face a shop window as Hendrids stopped at an intersection and checked behind her. He watched her out of the corner of his eye while pretending to study a hat, then turned to follow her again once she'd kept going.
I dyed my hair after I last saw her. Mikkel explained. It won't hold up to a close examination, but it's enough to fool her at a distance.
Is she that stupid?
People are that stupid, Mikkel responded. You'd be surprised at what even a cautious person will overlook.
They soon left the industrial quarter and passed the old dockside market and the ruins of the eastern face of the plateau. Out in the harbour, Fort Nide sat pitted and forlorn, mostly ignored by the occupying force. Hendris crossed the river and rounded the plateau to head into the northern suburbs. She stopped at two different buildings, both times briefly, before continuing her journey. One of the stops was at the bar of a known Black Hat contact, and the second was unfamiliar to Mikhail. He tried to put himself in her shoes, working through her route, trying to figure out what she was doing.
"How do we know when we've followed her to the right place?"
Tenik asked quietly while they waited for her outside yet a third stop.
"We don't," Mikhail responded. "It might be obvious, or we might have to stake out all of those places." "We're trying to find this other gold rose?"
"Exactly. If we're lucky, she'll have already made contact with him since my departure, and she'll lead us right to him."
"If we're unlucky?"
"If we're unlucky, she's spotted us and is leading us into a trap." With those words, Mikhail double-checked his pocket to make sure his knuckle-dusters were still there. They were. He didn't want to be caught unawares again, like he had with Fulgula. He stopped at an intersection to wait for a column of Dainai's soldiers to walk by, tipping his hat to them. Tenik gave him a questioning look.
"Force of habit," Mikhail said. "You're less likely to notice someone with good manners. Not great manners, mind you, just good ones."
The column passed by, and he swore under his breath.
"I don't see her," Tenik said.
"Me neither.
Pit. Head down, keep walking. Watch to your right out the corner of your eye. I'll watch the left."
They continued straight down the street past a row of shops, half of which were boarded up. This was a residential area, lower middle class, and had maintained much of its population after the evacuation. No one paid them any mind, and after they'd gone two blocks, Mikhail whispered to Tenik to turn around. They did a second sweep, coming up with nothing.
"She's got to be in one of these buildings," Mikhail said. "But the longer we linger, the more chance she'll look out her window and notice us standing around." "Over here."
Mikhail headed into a nearby bakery, following his nose into the front of the shop, where hot loaves had just come out of the oven.
"Don't stand out," he said quietly. "Buy something."
Tenik went up to the counter, while Mikhail turned to watch out the front window.
"We don't take those," a voice said loudly.
Mikhail turned to find Tenik offering the baker a Dainai's ration card. Tenik opened his mouth, but Mikhail stepped in to intercede, handing over a couple of Fatrastan coins. He thanked the baker and pulled Tenik back outside, where he tore the loaf in half. Tenik scowled back at the door.
"These are valid," he said, shaking the ration cards under Mikhail's nose. "The government has ordered that all businesses accept them."
"Don't worry too much about it,"
Mikhail said, bemused by Tenik's indignation.
"You look like a Palo and dress like a Palo. They're going to treat you like one. Which means they won't let you pay with a currency that might not be any good in a few months."
"He thinks Dainai's will lose the war?"
Tenik looked like he was ready to march back inside. Mikhail took him by the arm and led him away.
"Edging his bets, probably. Like I said, don't worry about it."
Mikhail trailed off as he spotted someone over Tenik's shoulder.
"Don't turn around," he said in a low voice, lifting his half a loaf of bread up to his face, but keeping his eyes fixed down the street.
"Loosen up," he told Tenik. "Your shoulders are hunched and your body tense. That's going to be obvious to anyone who knows what to look for. Now, I see Hendris just over your left shoulder. She just came out of the alleyway next to the cobblers. We're going to stay here until she moves again. If I say turn, I want you to casually look at that playbill plastered on the wall to your left.
Understand?
Yes.
Good. Mikhail watched for several moments as Hendred spoke with someone just around the corner. He silently urged them to step out into the street so that he could see the other party, but Hendred was suddenly on the move again. Turn! He hissed at Tenek. They waited as Hendred walked past them. Mikhail forced himself to breathe evenly, watching out the corner of his eye until she rounded a corner. He glanced over Tenek's shoulder once, and then took one step after Hendred's, before freezing in place.
"Should we follow her?" Tenek asked.
Mikhail didn't answer. Slowly, casually, he swept his gaze back across that alley Hendred's had been standing in a moment ago. A man had emerged to chat with one of the shopkeepers, smoking a cigarette carelessly.
"She's getting away."
"Forget about her," Mikhail said. "We got lucky. Damn lucky."
"How?"
Mikhail took Tenek by the arm and led him down a nearby alley without answering the question.
"Where are we going?" Tenek asked.
"To find a lookout spot. The man who Hendrist just met with is named Mahush. He's a silver rose, and he's the right-hand man of Valjatura. Not only is Jatura Lindit's personal enforcer, but he also spent most of the Fatrastan Revolution killing Kez soldiers and civilians with explosives. I'm willing to bet Jatura is the one bombing your soldiers, and Mahush will lead us right to him."
Chapter 17. Stike, Selene, and Karpol rode for 3 days in near silence, broken only by Selene's occasional questions about the people and horses they passed on the road. They travelled against the flow of traffic as thousands of refugees left their homes and businesses and fled northwest in an attempt to stay ahead of the Dianai's invaders. Stories travelled with them. A thousand rumours that painted the Dianai as everything from blood-drinking monsters who snatched away Cressian youths to liberators who brought with them freedom from the oppressive rule of Lindit and her black hats. Regardless of which rumour was carried by the passing travellers, everyone seemed to prefer taking their chances with the evil they knew, Lindit, rather than the evil they did not. By the third day, Stike found the spring that gave birth to the Cottonseed Tributary, a small river that meandered between plantation fields for about 30 miles, growing bigger until it joined the Cottonseed River and eventually poured into the Hadshaw. Stike stopped at the spring, washing the road dust off his face and instructing Selene to do the same before making sure his carbines were loaded and his knife was sharp. After a brief lunch, he lifted Selene back into the saddle and followed the banks of the tributary.
"What are we looking for?" Selene asked.
"The closest plantation."
Stike handed the reins to Selene and removed a skull and lance banner from his saddlebags before tying it to the tip of his lance and raising it above him. They crossed several streams and a mile of plantation fields full of bonded palo, working desperately to harvest the half-grown fields. No one challenged Stike as he rode past, but Karpol received more than a few curious glances.
"Who are we going to kill?"
Selene asked.
"Try not to sound so eager when you ask a question like that,"
Stike retorted.
"I'm going to kill a man named Bad Tenny Wiles."
"And who is that?"
"One of the Mad Lancers," Stike answered. "At least, he used to be. Sometimes he was a clerk, sometimes did some cooking. A mean son of a bitch. Mean enough to keep the men from pilfering the rations when times were lean. But we were all mean back then."
"Why'd you want to kill him?" He felt a knot tighten in his stomach. Over the years, people had called him a brute, a murderer, even a monster. He'd been all those things and more, but the idea of killing someone who'd once ridden at his side was distasteful.
Murdering Agerston had sated his rage the other night, but it had also left him feeling queasy. He supposed he could just forget the whole thing, but vengeance needed having.
It was complicated.
So? She looked up at him expectantly.
Do you know what precocious means?
I know I'm one. Ibona said so.
Carpole grinned openly at Stike.
Of course she did.
Stike checked his knife and drew the blade down his whetstone a few times before stowing them both, taking the reins from Celine's hands. He wondered if he was getting such a young child too used to the idea of blood and death, and had to remind himself that she'd seen men gut each other over a biscuit in the labour camps, and she'd watched her own father drown in the fens. He pointed to the sorcery-healed scar on his left hand between the knuckles of his third and fourth finger.
"This,"
he said, then pointed to his leg, then his face.
"This and this. All from the firing squad 10 years ago."
The sorcerer's healing of his wounds had come 10 years too late, and they still ached every day. And those two fingers still didn't like to obey him. Celine took Stike's hand in hers, running her fingers over the wound, then across his knuckles. Her hands were tiny compared to his.
"Did Tenny Wiles shoot at you?"
"Not exactly."
Stike ignored Celine's further questions as he spotted a nearby driveway and directed Amrak away from the riverbank. The drive ran beside the river for a few hundred yards and then across an open lawn to a manor house. The manor had the typical flat facade in the common style of Fatrastan plantations. As far as those went, it wasn't immense, though it was obviously the home of a rich man. The fountain out front was in disrepair, the paint on the shutters peeling. But otherwise, the house and grounds were in decent condition for an older home. Stike felt his queasiness increase, and he thought about Agerston's blood on his hands and arms, and pictured the look on Tenny Wiles's face as he gutted him. Killing old comrades. A dirty business, even for him. A carriage and a dozen wagons filled the drive just outside the front door, and a flurry of activity filled the vestibule as servants rushed to load the wagons with furniture and supplies. Stike caught sight of Bad Tenny Wiles, standing on the front step, directing the whole thing. Tenny was probably 5 years younger than Stike, and hadn't borne the rigours of the labour camps, but he did not look good. His split nose was red and runny, and the side of his face with a missing ear was covered in the scars of a past infection. But it was definitely Tenny, just wearing expensive clothes. Everyone was so focused on packing the house that they didn't seem to notice Stike as he came up the drive, rounded the fountain, and dismounted. He pulled Celine down and set her next to Amrak, handing her the reins.
"Stay here,"
he said. The knot in his stomach was still there, but he could feel it loosening beneath the resolute feeling of a job that needed doing.
"I could come with."
"You don't need to watch me skin a man."
He pointed at Carpole.
"You stay here, too."
He left Celine scowling at his bag as he headed through the bustle of the servants and toward the front door, stopping just a few feet from the bottom step. He sighed, a hand on the hilt of his knife, and let his weight fall on his good leg as he waited for Tenny to notice him. It didn't take long. Tenny directed two servants manoeuvring a feather mattress out the door, pointing to one of the wagons. On noticing Stike, his mouth opened and he blinked in confusion. Slowly, the blood drained from his face.
"Hello, Tenny,"
Stike said. Bad Tenny Wiles, the scourge of unwary Kes infantry, began to tremble. It started in his hands, then moved through his body until Stike thought he might convulse and fall to the ground in a fit. He waited for a weapon to appear in Tenny's hands, and the quick exchange of blood to follow.
He did not expect Tenny to turn and flee into the house. The pounding of retreating footsteps surprised Stike, and it took him a moment to follow. He passed startled servants, listening to Tenny's shouts, and followed them up the grand staircase to the second floor. He paused for a moment on the landing, the house suddenly silent. "You there!" a servant called, mounting the stairs below Stike with a fire poker in his hand. Stike pointed his knife at the man, then continued upward. No one followed. He prowled the second floor, glancing in each room, moving in slow, deliberate steps. He expected the blast of a blunderbuss as he opened every door, or the ring of a pistol shot. But he found the master bedroom without encountering an ambush. Tenny stood in the center of the room alone, supporting himself on one corner of a four-poster bed. He'd stilled his trembles, and he held a pistol in one hand, pointed at Stike.
"Not another step," he growled. "I don't care if you're a ghost or the real thing, but I will pull this trigger."
"Do you think you can finish with one bullet what a firing squad couldn't with 20? Stike asked.
He entered the room, glancing around for a bevy of servants waiting to jump him. There was no one else, so he let himself relax slightly, glancing around at the furniture and ceiling as if he meant to buy the place.
"What's your price, Tenny?"
he asked.
"How much did Fidelis Jess pay you to betray me? Was it this place? A whole plantation? Well, I'll admit you got a good deal. I hope you enjoyed the last 10 years more than I did."
Tenny's pistol didn't waver.
"How did you know? Pay it how you're still alive. Just tell me they finished the job."
Stike had once watched Tenny kill a whole squad of grenadiers with a broken sword after one of them cut off his ear. He'd never heard that edge of panic in bad Tenny Wiles's voice. But seeing a ghost will do that to a man.
"I spent 10 years in the labour camps, thinking that Fidelis Jess had arranged my failed execution, then disappearance, without any of my men knowing. I shouldn't have been so naive. I got out 2 months ago, reformed the Mad Lancers, and helped defend Landfall. So how do I know? Turns out, you didn't come to my funeral. Marcus and Zack noticed, and they found out that you and a few others got paid off by the Blackheads. It doesn't take much math to figure out why."
I didn't,"
Stike cut him off.
"I know, Tenny. I killed Agaston a few days ago."
"Does everyone else know?"
Tenny whispered.
"Me, Ibana, Jackal, Marcus and Zack," Stike said. "I haven't decided whether to take your head back to show the rest. You're lucky Ibana isn't here. She would..."
As Stike spoke, the muzzle of Tenny's pistol suddenly dipped, then jerked up toward his mouth. Tenny grabbed the muzzle in his lips and squeezed his eyes shut. Stike crossed the room in 2 quick strides and jerked the pistol out of Tenny's hand. He tossed it on the bed, grasping Tenny by the front of his suit and shaking him hard enough to rattle his teeth. Tenny reached for a knife at his belt, but Stike slapped it away and lifted Tenny off the ground. He drew his boss knife and held the tip to Tenny's throat. A quick jerk, and Stike would have another traitor's lifeblood spilling down his arms.
"You don't get to take your own life," Stike snarled. "You gave up that privilege the moment you betrayed me and the Lancers."
"I didn't want to, damn it. Agaston and Devorey talked me into it. They said we were better off without you. And Fidelis Jesse..."
Stike shook him again. "Don't mention that piece of shit. You know what I did after landfall last month? I found Jess and cut his damn head off and sent it to Lindit."
He looked around the room, feeling angry and sick.
"You traded me for this, Tenny. Don't worry. because you only have to live with it for a few more minutes.
Finish that job,
he told himself silently. Have it done and be gone. He thought of Agaston's blood and squeezed his eyes shut.
You don't have to do it, Ben, Tenny whispered.
Oh, shut up.
Stike carried Tenny across the room and threw him out the big bay window. Glass shattered, and Tenny's scream was undercut by a shrill one from the closet. Stike whirled as the closet opened, and a woman in her early 20s burst forth. Two young children hid among the clothes inside, frightened, staring at Stike. A crippled giant of a man with a fighting knife as long as a sword. The woman looked from him to the window and took a step back, her eyes rolling like those of a frightened horse.
Stay here, Stike ordered.
He strode into the hall to find a crowd of worried servants. Shoving them aside, he headed downstairs and out to the side of the house, where he found Tenny lying on the lawn among broken glass and fragments of a windowsill. Tenny's eyes were closed, his arm bent beneath him and obviously broken, but his chest rose and fell. He gnashed his teeth against the pane, trying to move. Tenny's eyes shot open as Stike approached.
Are you still alive? He whispered between gritted teeth.
Stike squatted beside him, knife loose in his hand. Above them both, the woman stood at the window, wailing.
"Because none of the gods have invented anything to kill me yet," he replied. "Don't pretend this is a surprise. You knew who and what I was when you decided to sell me to Fidelis Jess."
He tapped the tip of his knife against Tenny's collarbone. Tenny trembled, but Stike could tell that it was from pain and no longer fear. He could see the acceptance of a dead man in Tenny's eyes.
"Got me," Tenny said. "Flay me. Do what you need to do. I deserve it. But leave these people out of it. Don't do it in the sight of my wife and children. I know who and what you are, Colonel, and I know you are better than that."
Stike glanced up at the window again. The woman had disappeared, and only servants stared down at him. He could still hear her wailing. He wondered if begging had ever stalled the blade of the old Ben Stike, if the invocation of a wife and children had ever kept him from a bloody deed. If it had, it was a long time ago. He felt eyes on him, and glanced over his shoulder to find Celine standing by the corner of the house. She still clutched Amrek's reins, and the big horse nibbled at the grass without a care in the world. Stone-faced, Celine watched Stike, eyeing the knife in his hand and the man at his feet. Carpole stood behind her with an appraising look in her eye.
"Finish it, Stike," Tenny said. "Don't make me linger. It's not your style. Drag me into those woods over there. Finish the job. Just don't do it in front of them."
Stike frowned at Celine. The girl's head was cocked to the side as if she were watching a butcher about to cut up a side of beef. He felt conflicted. That war between his lust for vengeance and the sickness brought on by killing his own men. Celine scowled at him, clearly finding something amiss. Stike bowed his head. Tenny deserved to die, no question about that. But Stike couldn't help but hesitate. He took a deep breath, let out a sigh, and tapped Tenny's collarbone with the tip of his knife again.
"Get that arm set and wrapped," he heard himself say softly as he stood. "The Dionys are close by. If you leave by sundown, you might outrun their scouts. The river valley is choked with refugees, so you'll want to go southwest."
"What are you doing?"
Tenny gasped. He tried to sit up, voice dripping with suspicion.
"I'm not going to skin an old comrade in front of his own household, even if you deserve it. Get out of here, Tenny. Change your name.
You should probably leave the country. If Ibana ever finds you, she'll turn you into a rug.
Stike sheathed his knife and headed back to Selene. He took Amrek's reins.
I thought you were going to skin him, Selene said.
Nobody likes a bloodthirsty little git, Stike said, swinging into the saddle.
Selene climbed up in front of him.
I'm not bloodthirsty, she protested. I was just curious. Why didn't you kill him?
Stike took her by the shoulder. He searched her eyes for eagerness or disappointment. Finding neither, he flipped the reins.
Hardest thing a soldier can do is leave the killing behind him. Fenny didn't sell me out for money or power. He sold me out for a better life. Shitty thing to do. But he went somewhere he couldn't hear the hooves and the cannons and became a good husband to a fat little country girl. He did what I should have done 25 years ago.
So you're just going to let him go?
I'm just going to let him go,
Stike confirmed. The rage still burned in his chest, but that queasiness was now gone.
I've got plenty of killing to do. One less mark on my knife handle won't make a difference. Just don't tell Ibana.
Chapter 18. The rolling plains of southern Fatrasta turned into the foothills of the Iron Hook Mountains as Flora and Taniel rode north ahead of the army. They followed the banks of the Hadshaw for nearly 300 miles, pushing themselves and their spare horses hard before cutting west and heading into the mountains. The roads became narrower, climbing steep hills and crossing deep ravines over bridges that became increasingly untrustworthy. Farmsteads gave way to forests of towering pines as they left behind the regular villages. Progress grew slower and slower as the terrain sharpened. The depth of the forest gave Laura a sense of foreboding. More than the swamps of the Tristan Basin, this land felt as if it were on the edge of civilization, isolated and wild, a place where she could scream for 10 miles of road and no one would hear her. They bought supplies from the infrequent logging camps and express depots, and it took them almost 7 days to reach the outskirts of Yellow Creek. The county limits were marked by a flatboard nailed to a stick, written in charcoal, and guarded by a rough-cut log tower with 2 men armed with rifles. The guards watched them approach, but did not hail them or comment on their passing. Flora turned in her saddle to look back at them as she passed.
Not much of a guard post.
They aren't looking for Cressians, Taniel said.
This should have surprised Flora.
Palo?
Definitely Palo. Cressians out here stick together. They have to, or the Palo war parties will pick them apart.
I didn't know there still were aggressive tribes this close to the coast. We're just a few 100 miles from landfall.
Taniel looked up to watch the circling buzzard.
There are a handful of independent tribes on this side of the Iron Hook, but they all have treaties with Lindit in order to ensure their survival. The problem is expeditions from the other side of the mountains.
Then why was that guard post down here? Why wasn't it up in the mountains?
Taniel grinned at her.
You ever try to explain the difference between groups of Palo to the average Fatrastan?
No.
That kind of nuance is lost on most people. A Palo is a Palo, regardless of where they come from. If Palo from across the mountains attacked the trade routes to and from Yellow Creek, the townspeople just assume it was one of the neighboring tribes.
Taniel tapped the side of his head.
People desperate enough to come out here to settle the frontier don't always have the best critical thinking skills. It's easier to shoot first and ask questions later.
Flora spotted a cabin at the top of a nearby gully.
the first sign of settlement she'd seen in 20 miles. A few minutes later, she spotted another one. "Damn near getting crowded now," she muttered to herself. "So these Palo coming across the mountains, are they from the Palo Nation?"
"Almost certainly."
"I thought you said they were different, more civilized."
Daniel considered this for a moment.
"The Palo Nation is complicated. They have no interest in having what happened to the southern Palo happen to them, so they sit behind the mountains and send raids. They scout, they kill, and steal. They do what's expected of them, because they don't want Lindet to suspect that they are anything more than an upstart tribe."
"Then what are they?"
Taniel looked at her seriously.
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you.
Try me.
They're a republic."
Vlora scoffed. "You're joking."
"Not at all."
"A bona fide republic?" Taniel nodded, and Vlora found herself struggling with the idea. She fought the Palo up in the Tristan Basin. They weren't stupid by any means, but their tribal societies didn't have room for a concept like republicanism. They lived year to year, fighting among themselves, in a place where survival of the strongest was the rule. She'd always considered advanced forms of government a civilized luxury.
"How do you know?"
she asked.
"I lived with them for a while."
He pulled off his glove, showing her the reddened skin of his right hand.
"Who do you think funds the Red Hand?"
"I assumed it was leftists in Landfall."
"Some of it, sure. But the Palo Nation loves having Lindet run around after freedom fighters instead of pushing closer to their territory."
"Does she have any idea about any of this?"
"Honestly, I can say that this is one of the few things Lindet doesn't actually know."
Vlora imagined the look on Lindet's face when she found out that there was a literal Palo Nation just on the other side of the Iron Hooks.
"Aren't there explorers?"
"Plenty. But Cressians don't last long beyond the Iron Hooks."
"Oh? Then how did you?"
Taniel's face soured.
"I was with Carpole, for one thing. For another..."
He trailed off.
"Yeah? I had to murder a small army in self-defense to get them to leave me alone."
Flora quickly dropped that line of questioning. Her attention shifted to the larger number of paths diverging off the main road into the forest, and then a small family they passed driving a wagon the opposite direction. The one wagon became two, then four, then 10. It was the most traffic they'd seen since leaving the Riflejacks behind.
"There's a lot of Palo," she commented to Taniel, watching a woman pass by with a yoke over her shoulders, suspending two pails of water.
"They're good labour."
"I thought you said that Cressian settlers don't like Palo."
"They don't like sharing an address or a drink with them. They do like how hard they work."
"How the pit are those guards back there supposed to tell the difference between a good Palo and a bad Palo?"
"The way they're dressed," Taniel said.
He tugged at the front of his buckskin jacket. "If they're dressed like me, they're bad." He pointed to her jacket and tricorn hat.
"If they're dressed like you, they're good."
"That's stupid."
"Like I said, no time for critical thinking on the frontier."
They finally reached the outskirts of town, a muddy track that suddenly turned muddier, and led under an enormous wooden sign that said, "Welcome to Yellow Creek." The canyon opened up into a large valley a couple of miles across, clear-cut and organized, and filled with wooden buildings of all sorts. Hardware stores, whorehouses, banks, letter-writing services, cobblers, and everything in between.
The town itself was dense and claustrophobic, trash and shit trod underfoot, and filling of Laura's nostrils with a vile stench. The scenery around them, however, was gorgeous. Mountains rose in every direction, shooting up from the pine-forested foothills to bare rock that towered impossibly high into a ribbon of clouds.
"I miss Adro," Taniel said quietly.
Flora turned toward him sharply, but his face was impassive.
"So do I," she said.
They rode deeper into the town in companionable silence, and Flora realized that she would be shocked if the town housed fewer than 10,000 people. Not a proper city, certainly, but a veritable metropolis this far out on the frontier.
"This is much bigger than I expected," she said over the din of the traffic.
Taniel's eyebrows rose.
"I'll admit I'm a little surprised. I've never been in a gold rush town bigger than a few hundred people. There must be a damn huge amount of gold in these mountains."
He raised his hand.
"This'll do."
Flora followed him across the street to a large building on the corner of an intersection. Large letters over the roof proclaimed "Hotel," while a sign beside the door said, "Vacancies. No Palo, no Girlish." Flora nearly objected, before realizing that every proper-looking building on the street had a similar sign. Some rejected Kez, others rejected Stren or Rosvelians. There was even one sign that said in bold letters, "Adrans not admitted."
"I see this is a happy, inclusive place," she commented, tying her horse to a hitching post. "I thought you said the Crescians stick together."
Daniel looked uncertain for the first time since the Dionys had arrived.
"It's been a while since I've been up this direction. It seems old hatreds are cropping back up."
Flora bit back a comment about Daniel not knowing as much as he thought he knew. She was still uncertain about his ulterior motives in this whole endeavour, but she did trust him. There was no reason to upset him if she didn't have to. The hotel great room was two stories, highlighting a winding staircase and a row of rooms that looked down from the balcony above them, with hallways going off to the side. Most of the main area was taken up with a bar and tables. At this hour they were empty but for a pair of drunks bemoaning some awful fate over in the corner. Flora and Taniel were greeted by a wormy little man in a faded purple jacket and flat cap. He called to them from behind a podium that said in block letters, "Hotel Manager." He said something quickly in Brudanian.
"We need two rooms," Flora told him.
The manager switched to Adran.
"Oh, two rooms will be tight, I'm afraid. The city's very crowded right now, and most of the guests are doubling or even quadrupling up."
He followed the silence with a simpering laugh. Flora looked at Taniel, who just shrugged at her, and decided she had no interest in sharing a bed, no matter how platonic, with an ex-lover.
"How much?" she asked.
"40 for the week. 60 includes lunch and dinner. Drinks are extra."
Flora plunked a handful of large coins on the podium, sorting through them carelessly, and then sliding two across to the manager.
"Two rooms."
She slid another two across to him. The manager licked his lips.
"Ah, oh, I think we've just had a vacancy."
"Good."
The manager hurried away, and Flora turned to look across the great room. It wasn't much, but it would be home for the next couple of weeks. Taniel slid up next to her, leaning in so that only she could hear him.
"You haven't really learned subtlety, have you?"
he asked. She felt her already dubious mood sour.
"I'm a goddamn Adran general. I don't do subtlety."
"You're not an Adran general here," Taniel said. "We've got to stay low until we find this thing.
You saw those postal relays on the highway. Word could reach Lindard about our presence within a week. The notes I found in her personal library indicated she was already snooping around in this neck of the woods, so she doubtlessly has spies in the city. The Dynais might, too. Vlora grunted. As much as she hated to admit it, Taniel was right. Their whole purpose here, coming without her army, was to get in and get out without being detected by enemy agents. Handing the manager enough money to buy a horse just to get an extra hotel room was probably ill-advised. The manager returned with their keys and a pallid smile.
If there's anything else I can do for you, please let me know.
His eyes ran across Vlora and Taniel's weapons, then he leaned across the podium conspiratorially.
You'll do well here, I think.
Vlora, whose attention had wandered from the dislikable man, turned to him sharply. What do you mean by that? The manager recoiled.
I mean with the troubles brewing. You're soldiers of fortune, aren't you, mercenaries?
Taniel didn't look any happier than Vlora.
What kind of trouble?
He asked.
The picks and the shovels,
the manager explained.
I assumed you came here because of the newspaper advertisements.
Happenstance, actually, Vlora assured him. She looked at Taniel, then continued on cautiously. We just thought we'd find work guarding some caravans or mines.
A happy coincidence in your line of work,
the manager said with a tone of voice that implied he expected a large tip.
Trouble's been heating up the last few months. There's two groups in town that own most of the big mines around here, and they've been trying to buy each other out. The Picks own most of the eastern side of the valley.
He waved vaguely over his shoulder.
And the Shovels own the west side. Their big bosses have been bringing in more and more muscle to try and make a point. If one of them don't agree to sell, it'll be bloodshed by the end of the month.
Vlora prayed they'd be gone by then. The last thing she needed was their presence being complicated with a war over prospecting rights. She thought back to the Palo in the Tristan Basin, and then in Greenfire Depths, and realized local politics had been plaguing her entire time in Phatrasta. She plastered a thankful smile on her face and palmed a 5-kroner coin, shaking the manager's hand. Have those rooms cleaned out by supper. Fresh linen, and flip the mattresses. She retreated to the front stoop of the hotel, feeling suddenly claustrophobic. The pungent smell of the mining town didn't help, but turning her face to the sun allowed her to breathe more easily. A few minutes passed before Taniel joined her.
You're getting posh in your old age.
Vlora opened one eye and glanced sidelong at Taniel. And you're still just a bit of a smug asshole, you know that? There was more bite in her words than she'd meant, but she let them stand. Instead of getting angry, Taniel laughed.
I won't argue that. You and Dad were really the only ones that ever seemed to notice.
Everyone noticed, but they were scared of either you or Tamas. That famous family temper. Come to think of it, I haven't seen it come out since you resurfaced. Taniel's smile disappeared, his forehead creased.
I don't want to be my father.
Vlora bit back a remark. Taniel had fled from his father's legacy, faking his own death. Vlora had embraced that legacy and become the renowned general. But at the end of the day, she didn't have Tamas's political skills to deal with the Adran government. Coming here with a mercenary army had been her own sort of running away, so calling Taniel out on his seemed more than a little hypocritical. Flora let the silence stretch, taking in the city. It was much drier up here in the mountains than it had been in either Landfall or the Tristan Basin, and she was glad for it. The heat was more bearable, too, but she imagined the bugs would be just as bad come nightfall.
"I'm going to go for a walk," she said, eyeing a nearby bar.
"Get the bearings of the city."
"Good thinking. I'll do the same."
They split up, heading in different directions down the street. Flora waited until she was out of sight and ducked into one of the dozens of bars that seemed so prolific along the main thoroughfare. It was barely a building, not much bigger than a good hotel room, with three tables and a single barkeep pouring drinks for the miners heading toward or coming back from the hills. She ordered a beer and took a seat facing the open door, watching the faces pass her in the street, and put her feet up on the chair opposite to discourage company. The beer was terrible, but it was cold, and she downed it quickly and went for another. It took a lot for a powder mage to get drunk, but she wasn't looking for that. Just the slightest buzz to take the edge off the soreness from a week in the saddle, and a week with Taniel. She wondered why it bothered her so much. They'd parted on good terms, and she hadn't seen him for 10 long years. In the years since, she thought long and hard about whether she had any residual feelings for him, and decided it wasn't that either. Perhaps it was because they'd been practically siblings before becoming lovers. Taniel and Tamas had saved her from the streets and given her purpose, and Taniel had been her closest friend and confidant. She wondered if there was a part of her that wanted that back. Taniel's murky ambitions and her own growth over the last decade made that an impossibility. Laura's contemplations and her fourth beer were cut off by a figure passing through the street outside the bar. She frowned, tilting her head to the side and glancing at the glass in front of her. She almost ignored the figure, but curiosity got her to her feet and out onto the stoop. She caught another glimpse and hurried along the walkway to try and get another one, pausing for a moment at the next intersection as the figure finally turned to give her a view. It was a tall, distinct-looking woman with the shoulders of a boxer and long brown hair in a ponytail. She carried a blunderbuss, casually, on one shoulder, and the right side of her face was reddened by an old blast wound that left her eye milky white. Flora was certain she knew the woman, yet hesitated for long enough that her quarry slipped down a side alley. Flora hurried across the street and turned down the alley, only to come face to face with the flared muzzle of a blunderbuss.
"Follow me one more step and I will blow you..." "Flora?"
"I'll be damned," Flora said, raising her hands, open palms outward. "It is you. How are you, little Flaring?"
"You'll be damned. By Adam, Flora, what a pity you're doing in Yellow Creek."
Flaring lowered the blunderbuss and thrust a hand toward Flora, which she shook happily.
"It's a long story, but I could ask you the same thing."
The conversation was interrupted by the arrival of Taniel, who stepped into the alleyway behind Flaring, his sword drawn. Flora turned to him sharply.
"Were you following me?"
"I was just trying to catch up."
"I thought we'd split up for the night."
Taniel stared at Flaring, clearly unwilling to say more in front of her. He eyed her blunderbuss for a moment before putting up his sword. He did not answer her question. Flaring looked back and forth between Flora and Taniel, finding herself boxed in, and scowled at Taniel.
"Who the pit is this? Aren't you still with Olam?"
"It's not like that," Flora explained, gesturing Taniel to join her.
He slipped past Flaring and came to stand beside Flora. He leaned in, speaking in a whisper that only she could hear.
So you know each other?
We do, Flora said. She's a long-time contractor for the Adran army.
She smiled reassuringly at Flering and said in a low voice,